Hello everyone, this is Isaac from IlluminatiWatcher.com and you are listening to the Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture Podcast. Now today's main focus, we're going to be to analyze Stephen King's It, both the movies and the novel. But first, I want to give a quick shout out to all the Patreon subscribers out there. I started this project a couple weeks ago and I am getting a lot of great feedback from it. And I really appreciate the supporters that have gone on there and signed up, because the people that do sign up allow me to find ways to improve this Illuminati Watcher project. An example immediately was that I increased the hosting bandwidth I'm allowed to have for my podcast. So, you know, you can thank the Patreon subscribers for that, or you can chip in as well. And we can, work on the podcast a little bit. I know a lot of people like this. It's a very popular item. And the more support I can get behind it, the more I can get more guests, take more time away from, you know, writing the articles and the YouTube videos and the books and whatnot. So I just want to quick run through the names of those that have supported me to show my gratitude. Camilla, Juan, PB, Meredith, Leela, Emily, Julie, Tina, Rebecca, Dave, Elizabeth, Bonnie, Vicky, ZJ, Dan, Stephen, Miriam, Carolee, Michael, Allison, Jessica, Scott, Jonathan, Gonzalo, Jennifer, Joe, and Florian. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all your support. If you haven't seen the Patreon page yet, go over to the Illuminati Watcher Patreon. I've also got links on IlluminatiWatcher.com. Check it out, see what it's all about, and join the team. I actually was trying to research a little bit about Patreon after I already launched it, after the fact. And what I was reading was that they advised to create reward tiers. So I actually launched this thing without any reward tiers because I didn't really see the point in it. I just thought this was more or less a, you know, fundraising opportunity. But since then, I've made a $5 tier. That's the tier one. And what that'll get you is extra bonus content. And what that is exactly, it's hard to say. It varies from time to time. It just depends on what's going on. The most likely common example is going to be extra podcast material. I'm going to switch it over to a new format where I do kind of the first half for free, and then the second half will be for the Patreons that are in the Tier 1 and above group. There is also a Tier 2 group, and what that gets you is all the Tier 1 stuff, but you'll also get the opportunity. What you could do is you can, every month, send a question to me, and I will not only research that question, but I will read it on the podcast and provide an answer of how I see it. So this is a good opportunity for all of us to learn a little bit. So if you want to do the tier two, that is also available. I recently did a podcast where I interviewed Dr. Frank Albo about his book on Astana, the Illuminati capital of the world. And what he gave me was a couple of bonus clues to solve his riddle that I gave to the tier one subscribers on Patreon. And what we're talking about is he's got this book, and if you can solve the puzzle he has in it, he will pay for a $30,000 all expenses paid vacation to Astana. I didn't ask him what happens when you get there, so, you know, the Illuminati sacrifice, you don't blame me, but no, I don't anticipate that would happen. But anyways, yeah, the tier one people got a couple bonus clues, one of which he said was a huge clue. I still haven't figured it out, obviously, but that is just an example of some of the things I have going. I'm also going to be arranging for maybe some of the guests that I have on, trying to get some autographed copies of their books to do giveaways for the supporters. Just stuff like that. Stuff that you guys will really dig. Now, the concept of today's show is I will be basically talking about Stephen King's It. And if you're curious as to if I'm going to have, spoilers, yeah, I will. Because what I'm thinking is I want to go through some of the similarities and differences between his original novel versus the 90s made-for-TV film versus the 2017 film that was just released and in theaters still. So if you do not want to ruin the storyline, if you're planning on reading the book or watching the movie anytime soon, I'd advise to turn back now, because I'm definitely going to talk about some of the final sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, final visions of Stephen King's darkness that you'll find in the book, which is kind of also in the 90s made-for-TV film, but not quite. Also, real quick, before I forget, because I'm kind of jumping around, I also want to give a thanks to all the people that are leaving reviews for the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. I am seeing them. Trust me, I'm looking at them. I really appreciate it. I see that there's a bunch on there in the last few months since I've been asking you guys to do that. So awesome. Thank you. Also, people that have read my latest book, The Dark Path, that have been leaving reviews on Amazon, thank you so much for the kind and well-written reviews. I have read every single one of them. I am very much humbled by your great words. That's awesome. Thank you. Now, let's get to the topic at hand. It. I read this book when I was a child back in the 90s. And, you know, it was a long book. It was like 1,200 pages. And I was able to read it because I was grounded for quite a long period of time. I'll let you in a little personal talk of my childhood, but my my dad wanted me to get nothing less than 2 C's per report card, and my dumb ass would get the grades that would allow me to not be grounded. Then the next report card, I would get 2 C's or worse and be grounded for the whole report card period, the whole marking period, until the next report card came out. So there was more than once where I would not have the proper grades on the last report card of the year, so I'd be grounded all summer and all of the first marking period till I got that next report card to exonerate myself. So, as you can see, that's, I don't know, 5 months maybe? So I had time when I was a child to read this book. And, in some ways I'm grateful for that, because the book was, it was amazing. But, you know, that was, I don't know, 25 years ago I read it maybe. So, I mean, this is a long time ago, and I don't remember a lot of the details. Some of it is very fuzzy. So when I saw that they were releasing the new film in 2017, I watched the 90s made-for-TV film again, because I actually saw that back when it came out, because the timeline is I read the book, then I watched the made-for-TV film. Then, 25 years later, I watched the 2017 film, and I compared the three. And I knew that there was a lot missing from the movies, obviously. Isn't that how it always works? So a friend of mine, Tommy, he actually read the book. Now, I was going to actually read the book again, because when I watched the new film, I thought it was pretty well done. But it did make me want to go back into the dark mind of Stephen King and re-experience the book. But Tommy was going to read the book, so I let him read the book and talk to him afterwards about some of the things I thought I remembered from it. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then since then, I've kind of went online and looked at a couple items of interest that we'll talk about. Some interesting connections that you can find with this tale. It's got some strange connections with the occult. We've got a little bit of David Icke's theory of the Archons, which are the shape-shifting reptilians that you hear about so often. There's also, various interesting symbols and themes that we're going to talk about. First, let's talk a little bit about it. Like, what is this book about, right? Stephen King, prolific author of horror, who is no stranger to sort of contact with this dark side, so to speak. He wrote this book about these children that are in this town of Derry in Maine. Because, Stephen King, he always writes his books in Maine. That's where he lives and is from. But it's about these kids, and they're sort of battling this entity, this clown, Pennywise, which you know, Pennywise is just a front for, it's a shape-shifting entity, so it's a front for this sort of darker evil, and it preys upon children in this town, and it sort of resurrects every so often, and it'll start killing kids. And it does that because it's sort of using the fear that they release, and we'll talk about that in a little while. But the novel, it goes through these kids that I believe it takes place in the 50s when they the one boy, Bill, his brother Georgie, gets killed. And they find a way to, you know, get down in the sewers because they find out where Pennywise is, because Pennywise is sort of harassing them and taking on different forms to attack these kids. And they go down there and try to kill him. Now, the book actually kind of like parallels both the story from the 50s when these kids are trying to defeat Pennywise, as well as when the kids become parents. Because what happens is, you know, they defeat Pennywise sort of in the 50s, and then 27 years later, they have to come back to Derry as adults to kill him once and for all, to kill it. So it kind of runs them in parallel. And, you know, as adults, they come back, and it's almost like a, you know, coming of age story of fighting the demons that you have as a child. But I think it's much darker than that. If you look at the actual story of what it is and the sort of extraterrestrial origins, I can see a lot of the ideas of the occult that we've been talking about for so long. And of course, there's a lot more going on in the book than that. But that's the basic gist of it. If you had no intentions of seeing the films or reading the book, that's basically what it's about. One of the first things I'd like to cover is in the film, in the 2017 film, you'll find that there was an explosion at the ironworks factory in Derry. Derry's the town that this takes place in. Now, the curious thing is that I believe it was 88 people died in this explosion, and it happened on Easter. Now, Easter is a time of importance for the occultists. Ostara is another name they called it. That was actually the name of the circular that influenced Adolf Hitler, because a lot of the Germanic pagan systems, they're the ones that came up with this idea of the Easter Bunny with the eggs, because obviously the eggs and the Easter Bunny have nothing to do with the Christian holiday of Easter with the resurrection of Jesus. So you can see that there's like some pagan connections to be had here. And you'll see how important this is in the story. When you get to the end of the novel, like I said, I'm going to definitely spoil a lot of the information from this book. So if you don't want to hear what really happens, you probably want to come back to this later. But in the novel, the final iteration of it is not the clown. It is the final, the most understandable and comprehensible form, which is a spider, and it's laying eggs. So in the 2017 film, you see a sort of preview to this, because one of the boys is in the library and he chases eggs down into the basement where, you know, Pennywise attacks him. Another concept we see in the film, 2017 film, Beverly is the young girl. She looks down the drain in her bathroom, and you can see the camera sort of pans into the all-seeing eye, focuses on the one eye. Most of you are already familiar with this concept. The all-seeing eye implies that the third eye or pineal gland is opened. This is a typical sign that means there's sort of an occult knowledge or awareness or enlightenment that's about to happen. Now, in the book, they actually battle a creature that looks like an eyeball with tentacles. And in the 90s film, you also see that there is a fortune cookie at this Chinese restaurant when the adults get back together, and an eyeball comes out of it and it, you know, scares the adults or whatever. Now, when you talk about that drain that Beverly is looking down with the all-seeing eye, eventually it explodes. The sink explodes and there's blood all over the walls. And, you know, none of the adults can see it. So the other children come over to help her clean the walls down. And this is actually something of importance when you talk to people who study this sort of thing. Like, there's a show called Dead Files, and the woman on there is a sort of medium channeler. And she talks about, on one of the episodes I saw, she talked about how the people that owned the house were having all these sort of like, you know, visitations or attacks. And she told them to do an actual physical cleansing. She told them to actually clean the walls down because the energy, the negative energy is kind of sticky is how she describes it. Which is the exact concept we see in the film because they, you know, besides like obviously not wanting to be in a bathroom covered in blood, but they allude to the idea that there's a certain energy attached to it. So they have to clean it down. Now, in the, you know, to stay on that same theme of Beverly in the 2017 film, when she goes into the drugstore, you'll notice there's a scene where she hits on the pharmacist. Now, this, to put it in perspective here, Beverly in the film is about 11 or 12, maybe 13, I'm not sure. And the pharmacist, he is, I don't know, 50 years old, maybe. So she is hitting on him, and she asks to, like, you know, try his glasses on, and he's kind of enjoying it, which is very creepy and disturbing. But when you also look at the idea that the pharmacist is the one who is sort of the pedophilia character here, and her Beverly's father is also in the films. But the pharmacist, when you look at, this comes from the Greek word pharmakia, is where pharmacist comes from. And this is talking about a sorcerer because it's referencing one who uses drugs or spells. And then another side note, the Hippocratic Oath actually starts out with the doctor swearing by pagan gods of ancient Greek world. Now let's talk about the Archons. This is where most of you will be interested to learn about David Icke and his theories of reptilian shapeshifting, because that's how it plays into this. You know, Stephen King wrote this book back. He said he came up with the idea in the late 70s, wrote it in the early 80s. So it's possible that David Icke might have taken some of the ideas from it. I don't know that to be true. David Icke actually, from what I've read, took some of his ideas from the television series V that has reptilian shapeshifters. But, you know, well, let's just get into it and we'll talk about it. Because if you want to know what it is, you have to read the novel. Granted, the second film in the modern update has not been released yet. So maybe it will explain it in the second movie. But if you look at the 90s made-for-TV movie, it did not. It did not cover it even close. And it, maybe it's very hard to depict it on a screen, but when you read the book, you get a sort of a more tangible feel of what it is and what this sort of, you know, it's an extraterrestrial shape-shifting entity of evil is the best way to describe it. And in the book, you find out it comes from a whole different dimension. It comes from the dimension that they call the Macroverse. And it crashed onto the Earth millions of years ago. This is long before the humans. Now, if that sounds familiar, that is because it sounds very similar to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, or Satan, perhaps, which could also take different demonic forms as well. But it's that sort of primeval alien entity that kind of creeps me out, because I feel like there might be some truth to that. I feel like Stephen King has a penchant for making contact with this sort of darkness, and it sort of has a bit of an intuitive feel to it. I don't know how to describe it besides that, but the entity that is in his book feeds on children. And why does it feed on children? Well, because they release fear as it is consuming them. As it is killing it, he uses this fear and is able to turn it into a form of sustenance. Now, if you followed my website or read my books, you know that this is a reference to David Icke. David Icke's belief in the Archon shape-shifting reptilians. This is also recently I wrote an article and put a video on YouTube about Billy Corgan, because he went on Howard Stern's show and was talking about how he quite literally saw somebody shapeshift in front of him. And I actually have the audio clip on that YouTube video, and you can listen to it. And Howard Stern, he actually did press him fairly hard, because when I first heard about this whole thing, I heard that Billy Corgan basically said, "Hey, I saw this guy shapeshift in front of me." And then Howard Stern kind of asked him about it for a second, but then he made a joke and dropped it. But that's not quite how it went. Stern pushed him a little bit. He said, "You know, was this something other than human?" And Billy Corgan confirmed that. He also confirmed that it was a shapeshifter, but he wouldn't go into any more detail. He said it was one of the most intense things he's ever been through, and that he was completely sober when he witnessed this. And he also alluded that he saw this, it was somebody in the music industry, I believe. So when David Icke for years has been talking about these shape-shifting reptilians, he also claims they're in the entertainment industry as well. They're in all industries. They are the puppet masters and controllers. They're at the top of the pyramid. He believes that it is sort of like the Anunnaki. It's this ancient race of extraterrestrials, and they have hijacked our perception. They use, according to David Icke, a system that takes sort of a signal from Saturn, sends it to the moon, and then the moon acts like an antenna, shoots it down to Earth. Our DNA is also an antenna, and it receives the signal. And these archons are creating an illusory world. Now, if any of this sounds familiar, it's because it is very similar to the ideas of Gnosticism, or in Buddhism, it's called Maya. It's this magic or illusion world. I don't know if I subscribe to that. I think it's a bit much. Descartes talked about this concept with the evil genius stuff. It's this idea that we don't know if we're living in reality or if this is just a cunning deception. Now, what I do find interesting, if you take this line of thought further and look at where technology is leading us, it leads us into the digital matrix. You've heard me yammer on and on about the transhuman movement. But that's ultimately where they want to take us, is these digital forms of consciousness, and sort of upload us into a digital matrix where we truly wouldn't be able to tell what's real and what's not. So anyways, David Icke talks about the shape-shifting reptilian entities, and that is exactly what this it is in Stephen King's novel. And it also is described, if you look at some of the descriptions online of it, they say that it can also manipulate people and use them as pawns into doing its bidding. And that's what David Icke talks about with these archons. He believes that these archons are reptilian in nature. They come down to Earth and they use fear as a form of sustenance. That's why our reality is so full of fear-driven concepts. He makes some pretty good analogies to, you know, hospitals are in the business of making you sick and keeping you sick by putting you on prescriptions instead of fixing the root cause. Jails don't actually reform anybody. Schools don't actually educate anybody. He talks about all this stuff, but he says that all of this is coordinated from these archons, and they take the fear that they produce from us, that we emit, they feed on it as sustenance, and that energy that they get from that is what it takes for them to stay in the human form, because they can shapeshift into whatever they want. So they shapeshift into the human form, and they use the fear, and, you know, I guess if they don't get enough, they shift back into reptilian form, and then they have to go in hiding. That's why you see these videos online of Justin Bieber and George Bush and President Obama's bodyguard, and you see claims that they're shape-shifting into reptiles because they are apparently running out of fuel. And another interesting connection, if you read the novel, Henry Bowers, he's one of the sort of antagonists that is the bully of the town that picks on the kids. As an adult, he's in a mental asylum. and he thinks the moon is talking to him. He thinks the moon is telling him to kill the other kids, because it basically tells him that, hey, the kids that used to bully, they're adults and they're all back in Derry. You should go kill them. So as an adult, he thinks the moon is giving him these messages. Well, that's what David Icke says the Archons are doing. They're hiding in the moon, and the moon emits or transmits or relays the signal that pushes fear and, you know, truly, I don't want to say satanic, evil concepts into our world. That's why there is, you know, all of these terrible things that happen, supposedly. Now, what another curiosity is, when we look at what it truly is, the most fundamental version that that you find in the novel and in the 90s made-for-TV film, it is actually like a spider. That's the best way that the mind can comprehend and see this ultimate form of evil. And inside this spider, it has these things called the deadlights. They're like an amber light. And if you look at them, the person sort of gets in a locked gaze, and it can kill them or drive them insane. Now, what's interesting here is that when you read Aleister Crowley talk about Corone Zone or Entering the Abyss, or Kenneth Grant when they talk about the Mauve Zone, they talk about this idea that you can gain enlightenment or go insane if you try to get into this hidden realm, the deadlights, or in the in Kabbalah, it's the realm of Daoth, this hidden Sephiroth. I talked about this at great length in The Dark Path as well, because you'll also see this in the Netflix series Stranger Things, which, not so ironically, is having a season 2 release on right before Halloween for Samhain this year. Another concept that we need to talk about is ritual magic and contact with the divine. Now, for years I've been talking about this when we explore the ideas of the occult and entertainment and hidden messages of the occult in entertainment. It always ties us back into the idea of ritual magic. It's this idea that people believe not in stage magic like David Copperfield, but more of a purposeful magic. They are truly seeking to cause changes in the world through their own will. That's what Aleister Crowley was all about. That's what a lot of people were about, a lot of occultists. So if you read my article on it online, you saw that in the 90s film, another friend of mine caught this one and sent them to me. In the 90s film, you'll see very, very clearly the Star of Chaos magic. This is the Star of Ishtar. And you'll see it in the background. and this, when we look at this, when we talk about the Chaos Star, we're talking about the idea of chaos magic. And this is the idea that anybody can use anything as a sigil. That's like why Disney films and stuff talk about magic. In chaos magic, anything can be magical. Any entity can be summoned. These magicians, they evoke entities to learn from their archetypes or characters. For instance, you could evoke Mickey Mouse from Disney and learn from it, from its archetype. Now, in the 90s film, when you see the Star of Chaos, you see it at the barn of Mike Hanlon. He is the one that stays back in the town and is the librarian. And when you read, a lot of Stephen King's books connect together. And Mike Hanlon's father, Will, was actually a friend of Dick Halloran, who was the black man in The Shining. Right? So if you remember, I talked about this in Kubrick's Code, how Stanley Kubrick was hiding a lot of ideas in his films. And the movie he infamously, his last movie, Eyes Wide Shut, actually had the same eight-pointed Star of Ishtar in it. Again, this is just different connections to be had there when you consider the idea of chaos magic and charging sigils and trying to cause changes in the universe through the mind and projections of the mind. You begin to find out how this plays out in the stories. Because in the novel, for example, Bill he's one of the main characters of this book. He uses a magic ritual to contact the divine. This is the same exact concept I've been talking about with when I read in Lords of the Left Hand Path. These occultists, they believe they can make contact with divine. They want to do it on their own. That's why they have a problem with religion, Christianity in particular, because you have to go through a priest to make contact with the divine. But the Apollonian and Dionysian concepts, they're all ways of altering the mind through whatever, drugs, dancing, drumming, sex magic, all these things. And Bill uses a magic ritual called the Ritual of Chud. This is an ancient ritual that allows him to enter this realm called the Macroverse, which is where it came from. And what's interesting is that in the novel, when Bill does the rituals, he comes across the ancient turtle that created the universe. And this turtle tells Bill that it can only be defeated through a battle of the will. So it's like a battle between magicians, which makes sense, right? I mean, this is the turtle is apparently telling him that the form of evil that was created needs to be defeated through magic, through the Ritual of Chud. And in the film in 2017, while, you know, the first film doesn't have the turtle scene in it, because it wouldn't, but the second film might, I doubt it somehow. But what's interesting is that if you watch the 2017 film, Bill goes into Georgie's room. Georgie is his younger brother that gets killed by Pennywise. Bill goes into Georgie's room and picks up a Lego turtle. Most people wouldn't really think much of it if they didn't know the story from the book, because in the 90s made-for-TV film, the whole deal with the turtle is absolutely not there. They totally don't go into it. But in the 2017 film also, when the kids are playing at the pond or quarry or whatever it is, Richie talks about how he just got bit by a turtle. Again, something that typically would go unnoticed. Now, what happens in the end of the novel, this is where Bill, he goes into the mind of the monster through the Ritual of Chud. And he finds that the true form is not even the spider, it's actually the Deadlights. So Bill fights the Deadlights through the will, the battle of the mental projections of energy, and he forces it to go back into slumber. This is back in the 50s when they're children. And then afterwards, Beverly has an orgy with all the boys. This is one of the controversial things that was talked about, how it's not in the film, because again, they're all 11, 12, 13 year old kids and they have this, you know, sex orgy. So obviously that's not in the films, but there was a lot of concern about this, and it just goes to show how dark the mind of Stephen King is. And, you know, the same concepts could be had for H.R. Giger, who made the Alien films, right? These artists, they're able to make contact with some other force, some other sort of supernatural realm. And I do believe in Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud's idea of these archetypes and symbols and archaic remnants. And I think there's like some truth to be had in all this. I mean, I don't know how to prove it besides like a gut feeling, but when I read the book, I could feel it. I can feel that there's a certain sense of evil that Stephen King could have been in touch with when he wrote this thing. And as absurd as it sounds that, you know, a turtle created the world and all this stuff, it's interesting that we see a lot of these connections to be had with modern day conspiracy theories of the occult and what's happening in our world. And David Icke talking about how the archons are making us live in a fear-based reality in order to sort of keep us from our true intentions and true purposes of being here and finding happiness. So that's my basic take on the whole film and the novel and how these things will play out. I don't know. We'll see how the second iteration, the sequel to It, goes. The box office smash that it became assures us that we'll definitely get the second part on the sequel. Online, they're saying that Chapter 2 is going to be released in September of 2019, exactly 2 years after the first chapter. So we'll see how that turns out. Hopefully they can shed a little light on this idea of this turtle. I somehow feel like it's a bit too much for the masses, and it might be a little too deep to even put on a film. As far as Stephen King himself goes, I've read a lot of ideas that he's part of the Illuminati, so to speak. He's pushing a Luciferian agenda. I don't know if I believe that. He obviously is in touch with some kind of darkness. I think he is able to translate that very well into the written word. From what I've read online, he believes in God, which God I don't know either, obviously. But I'm actually reading The Dead Zone right now. That's one of his other books that gets pretty good reviews. So I'll be curious as to where it goes. It's actually narrated by James Franco, who's doing a really good job with it, but he's got his own odd connections to the occult. If you look at his band called Daddy, they did a video several years ago that looked like a satanic ritual, almost, you know, image for image. And he also was a part of a ritual magic ceremony with Kenneth Anger, who's a prolific director of the occult variety, and he was there with a guy who's also in Twilight. I can't think of that guy's name, but they were both doing a ritual at some university in Southern California a few years back. You can find images of that online too. You can find it on IlluminatiWatcher.com if you can dig around and see where the James Franco articles are. But anyways, The Dead Zone, I'm reading that right now. We'll see where that goes. A lot of Christians seem to think Stephen King is evil of sorts. I don't know if I believe that. He definitely knows evil. I'll give you that much. On another sort of related note, on October 26, 2017, the remaining files on JFK are set to be released. Now, this was a 1992 law that enacted that these will be released on October 26th. But it did have the caveat, unless the president authorizes that they be withheld longer, and only the president can make that decision. And Donald Trump actually already tweeted saying that he would be opening those files. Shocker there. I was a little surprised to hear that, but we'll see if that actually comes true. Most of you know I'm not a huge fan of Donald Trump, but, you know, whatever. I'll give the guy a shot. If he's going to release those files, that'd be great. I'm interested to see if it lines up with some of the theories that a previous guest I had on here, Barry Katz, who did a documentary on a man who claims he was the one who killed Kennedy. So that will be released soon. We'll see what that brings about. It should be interesting for sure. One more curiosity I want to talk about real quick since I got a minute. This whole thing with Jesse Campos and the Las Vegas shooting, I watched the episode of Ellen that he was on, and I thought it was very freaking weird. If you haven't seen it, go watch it, because this whole Las Vegas shooting thing is very, very strange. They still don't have a timeline that makes sense. They still don't know why he did it. There's a million conspiracies going out there about it. It's been long enough now. I would think we'd have a little bit more of something of substance. And this guy, Jesse Campos, he was the official story is that he was a security guard in the Mandalay Bay. He went to investigate the shooting, you know, the room it was coming from. And when he went up the stairwell, the door that opened to that floor was blocked with actual brackets that were bolted in place. Now, he finally got his way around and he got shot from supposedly the shooter inside the room. He then, you know, called in for help and sort of told some people in the hallway to get out of the hallway. And then, the police came or whatever. But what's interesting is that apparently, from what I've read on like Reddit and 4chan, this Jesse Campos guy, he kind of disappeared after the shooting. Like no one could get a hold of him. No interviewers, no journalists, no nothing. And they kind of are trying to paint him as a hero, which, you know, perhaps he is if all that's true. But the interesting thing is, like, everyone glosses over the idea that there's these brackets, these braces that were put on the door. And even on the Ellen show, she kind of asks him, like, now I heard there was brackets on the door, and he said, yeah, and that was basically it. I mean, I find it very hard to believe that Mandalay Bay doesn't have cameras that can show who was putting those brackets on there. I mean, was it the shooter, maybe? Perhaps. But then on the show, some of the conspiracy theorists online are talking about the guy that was sitting on the couch with him who acted very much like a handler. And normally I dismiss those kinds of claims, but, like, this one was very strange. He, you know, two different demeanors altogether. And this Campos guy was, like, visibly distraught and shook. And they made a big stink about how this was the first and last interview he'll ever give. And, you know, it was a 5-minute clip on Ellen. And they had, like, they had a map. She was basically telling the official narrative story about what happened, pointing to this map that I'm sure Mandalay Bay gave her or whatever. And he's barely talking, and she's just giving the official narrative. And then they wanted to say that was the first and last interview they'll ever do with Jesse Campos. Now, if you don't think there's something weird with that, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to dismiss it as a traumatic incident for the guy, but I also think a lot of people have a lot of questions about this whole thing, and why he wouldn't want to talk about it more is very interesting. And it's very interesting that they just want to shut it down, any discussion about it. So I'm also keeping a close eye on this Vegas thing. So if you have any ideas of interesting theories that are being floated about that, you know, get them to me on whatever social media you are hooked up with me on, like Twitter or Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Illuminati Eyes, or I'm on Facebook, or you can leave a comment on the Patreon. I'm trying to stay real close up to date on the Patreon tab for the people that are subscribers on there, supporters. You can leave a comment on there. But yeah, that's a lot of what's been going on lately. That's my analysis of it. And I think there's going to be a lot more interesting ideas coming out of the second film in 2019. Unfortunately, we do have to wait those 2 more years. I'm dying to know if they put the turtle in the second film, or if they go into the idea that this thing is an extraterrestrial entity of evil. Because as you know, in The Dark Path that I wrote, that's the ultimate endgame, is trying to make contact with these extraterrestrials. I don't know why they are so obsessed with doing it, but to me it seems like these things could be demonic deceptions. It's happened many times in the past, we've been warned of it. We still get warnings to this day. When you look at people that ghost hunt and stuff, they get possessed, or even UFO abductions. People get the same symptoms as those who are possessed by demons. So, if you believe in a world of good and evil, or another version of reality with another dimension, which is what I believe in, then I think these things are valuable warnings to heed. So, anyways, I want to thank you for your time. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you have any more questions, or if you have any ideas of what guests you would like me to have on, shoot them over to me however you see fit. I am definitely going to increase the tempo of these podcasts, so hang on tight. All right, thanks again.